Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, our weekly interview program about the performing arts here in the Bay Area. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. We'll hear about the World Doctors Orchestra concerts to benefit at the San Francisco Conservatory this weekend. You'll hear from regular contributor Peter Robinson, who interviews about Cal Bach Society's performances of the St. Matthew Passion. Plus, choreographers Jess Curtis and Claire Cunningham talk about their latest work, The Way You Look at Me Tonight, being staged at Counterpulse. You'll also hear from Litquake's co-founder, Jane Ganahl, about this year's festival. And good friend of KLW, Paul Drescher, will have his work premiered next week with the Berkeley Symphony. He'll be here to talk about that. Stay with us. Let's start things off today on a dancing note. The Yerba Buena Center for the Arts and Counterpulse co-present Jess Curtis Gravity and Claire Cunningham in the world premiere of The Way You Look at Me Tonight. It runs through the 9th of October at Counterpulse in San Francisco, and it takes an interesting look at how we view differently abled people in the world of dance. I'm joined by Claire Cunningham, who is based in Glasgow, Scotland, as one of the UK's most acclaimed and internationally renowned disabled artist. Her work is often rooted in the study and use or misuse of her crutches and the exploration of the potential of her own specific physicality with a conscious rejection of traditional dance techniques. She's a former artist in residence at the Women of the World Festival at the South Bank, London, and of the Ulster Bank Belfast Festival at Queen's, and she joins me in studio tonight, today, this afternoon. I have no idea what time zone I'm in, actually.
Tell me about it.
Welcome, Claire. And she's joined by Jess Curtis, who is an award-winning choreographer and performance artist committed to an art-making practice informed by experimentation, innovation, critical discourse, and social relevance at the intersections of fine art and popular culture. Jess, welcome to Open Air as well.
Hi, David. Thanks.
Sure. Well, let's get started about how you guys first started to collaborate. Who wants to tackle that one?
Is it my turn?
A nod is going to Jess Curtis.
It's my turn in this interview. Claire and I started working together about 11 years ago. I was commissioned and Claire was cast to create a piece with a company in the Midlands in England. And we met actually the first day in rehearsal for that piece. So and it was an aerial piece that Claire at that time was doing some aerial work, and I saw some of the things that she was doing in the side of the studio, sitting on her crutches, or the way she would bounce across the room and use her crutches in different ways. And I thought, wow, we should choreograph something like that on her way over to the aerial apparatus, because that's so cool. And that kind of began. And then I invited Claire into a number of works over the last 10 years. And for my company, Claire was a guest artist or collaborator. And she invited me as a choreographic consultant.
Well, there we go. Okay.
On one piece of hers.
Jess, was Claire's an inspiration to you to work with differently abled artists, or had you done some work before with people?
Well, for one, we say disabled artists, kind of based on what in the UK and here is called the social model of disability, that people that are disabled are not inherently disabled, but disabled by societal constructs. So we kind of unapologetically, Claire.
I was going to ask Jess about that, Claire about that, in terms of terminology and political correctness, and how you've grown from an early age. Were you disabled from an early age? What is your story in terms of your mobility?
Yeah. I've always had a physical impairment from birth, and as Jess says, I exist in a place now where, yeah, I self-identify as a disabled artist, which means that it's a cultural identity for me as well as, so rather than being labelled as disabled, I take that label for myself because actually it's a huge part of how I engage with the world, but also as an artist it's become the lens through which a lot of my work manifests is looking at the fact that I use crutches, the fact that my body has evolved differently due to a degree of fragility in my bones means that I negotiate the world differently, I'm viewed differently, I'm perceived differently, and I perceive the world differently, which really underscores a lot of the work that Jess and I are doing in this piece. So the piece is, as we said, sort of tied into perception, but it's not specifically about disability. That comes from, that's my lived experience. Jess has a very different lived experience as a man and a woman, as a Scot and as American, as 6 foot tall, as not even 5 foot in my case. All of these things. So it's about how we perceive the world and how we are perceived generally as human beings to each other.
What's so wonderful about the fact that you're being involved in something choreographic is that your disability becomes ability and you're presenting a whole different presentation of yourself. When did you first come into choreography and dance as an outlet?
The kind of introduction to movement was kind of just around the time that I was meeting Jess. I trained as a classical singer originally. That is my background, and my degree is in music. And I worked in theatre as a singer and a performer. And I began to become more interested a little bit in movement. And as Jess mentioned, I went into aerial work. So because I'd cultivated a lot of physical strength in my body from using crutches, I began to do trapeze training and silk training. So there was a very mercenary point of like, oh, how can I use this strength? Maybe this is a way into it. And from doing that aerial work, meeting Jess, that first piece that we made really began to change the way that I viewed dance and movement, and acknowledged that what I was doing on the crutches was inherently interesting to a choreographer, but also then what was interesting and exciting to me was that Jess got me interested in that. So that became my own sort of personal exploration for the last decade has been what is the full potential of this body and the crutches, what is specific to it. And what does that offer in terms of my progress as an artist, but also how does it challenge people's preconceptions of dance and the aesthetics of bodies that are perceived only to be suitable for dancing.
It's Claire Cunningham who's presenting with Jess Curtis, The Way You Look at Me Tonight at the Counterpulse, 80 Turk Street in San Francisco, counterpulse.org for more information. Claire, that must be... The aerial aspect of things must be so freeing for you. I mean,
I don't do it anymore. It's hard work.
Is it scary?
No. Well, it's just I was interested in it at a certain period, and I tend, as an artist, I tend to always be interested in pushing myself into new places. The aerial was interesting at a point. I'm not sure that I considered it freeing. I was more interested in How did it respond to things that were inherent in my body? I had a lot of upper body strength. This was a really exciting place to explore. So, for example, I was interested in challenging that. I think it's a little bit of a cliche that disabled people want to be free of the earth, or free of their mobility equipment, and the idea of flying is quite nice, I think, for non-disabled people to think that disabled people want to fly. For me, it's very different. Like, my crutches empower me, my crutches offer possibility, as in, and a lot of my colleagues who use wheelchairs are absolutely an empowering piece of equipment. They are absolutely not something that constrains them. They offer the possibility to negotiate the world, so you don't want to be free of it. Actually, it's a really empowering thing. So for me, when I went into making my own aerial work, I made aerial equipment that was made of crutches. It's like, how can these further empower me? How can they further help me explore my physicality? So rather than leaving them behind, I don't want to leave them behind on the ground and fly off in the air. I want to take them with me. So that the work that I made was a piece called Mobile, which Jess came and worked on. And that was very much the trajectory of that narrative for me of like, oh, okay, they empower me down here. What can I do with them up here, up in the air?
So you said the aerial work is involved in this, but how are the crutches being used or not used in this particular work?
We talk a lot about crutches. We Claire gives me a lesson on how to use them. As a beginner, I've had to use crutches on several occasions in my life, and for various reasons of being injured. And Claire gives me the expert lowdown, and helps me to understand her virtuosity on crutches. And so then we're looking also at the ways that some of my experience of how I got to experience the way people looked at me differently when I have been on crutches, and kind of that comparison. And and then Claire does amazingly beautiful dancing on crutches, that doing things that are really only possible the way that Claire moves, only possible using her tools very, very virtuosically. So we partner, we bounce, Claire flies and floats and lands on me, and lots of different things happen.
It is a duo work then.
It's a duet. Although we like to say there are actually sort of 15 collaborators on stage, because there's a beautiful set and there's a video, video on three screens that is going, and the score by Matthias Herrmann is really, really beautiful. So there are a lot of collaborators. And Alvin Noe, Dr. Alvin Noe, who's a philosopher and famous author here from the Bay Area, from Berkeley, appears on stage through the video and in the audio.
We'll actually hear him shortly in an excerpt called Tall Crutches. This is actually stop number 3 on a 4-city worldwide tour, isn't it?
Well, it's actually a 7-city tour, it's the fourth. We're the third leg of the Rolling World premiere,
okay.
Which means that 4 different cities gave us a lot of money and wanted us to have the world premiere there. And I learned from, I think, ACT or somebody that you can refer to that as a Rolling World premiere.
Very nice. Well, that works out well. From here, back to Berlin, is that right? With additional performances in Miami and then in Washington.
Yeah, we go to Miami, Washington, and then Berlin the first weekend in November.
The performances on Friday, September 30th, and Saturday, October 1st, will be ASL interpreted. Well, the Friday performance, ASL interpreted, and then audio description service available in a pre-show touch tour available on Saturday, October 1st at 8. What's that all about?
So part of what we were very keen to do with this work, which is partly coming out of my history of working in the UK, where there's quite a strong tendency and history of trying to make work more accessible to a diversity of people, a diverse range, and particularly also pushing into accommodations for people with sensory impairments. So we really embedded into the research and the creation of this piece that at least one night in every show would be American Sign Language interpreted here in the States, and also that there is audio description for people with visual impairments and who are blind, that within the sound score of the work itself, we've tried to embed ideas and ways of describing what might be happening that create a kind of richer experience for people who might not be sighted. And then additionally, things like a touch tour, which is quite a common practice in the UK of before the show starts, we invite people with visual impairments to come early, and we kind of do a personal tour of the space to give a kind of sense of how the actual set and space is laid out, where things are, and a tactile sort of introduction to the space and to ourselves. And
some of the movement. And,
yeah.
And then there's a wireless, an available wireless headset that the audio descriptive track is made available to people with visual impairment, so that just fills in some of the visual information that everyone else is getting on stage, so that they're able to to make more sense or enjoy the piece more.
Well, you can enjoy a performance tonight at 8 as well as Friday at 8 and Saturday at 8 that will include a post-performance question and answer session with the performers. And then it concludes, at least in the Bay Area, on Sunday, October 9th. It's Jess Curtis, Gravity, with Claire Cunningham, The Way You Look at Me Tonight. A rolling world premiere here in San Francisco. Could you tell us a little bit about the excerpt we're going to hear, Tall Crutches, in which we'll also hear Dr. Alva Noe talk?
This comes quite near the end of the work, and a lot of the things that we explore in the work are just Jess and I have very different physicalities. As I said, I'm kind of not even 5 feet, Jess is over 6. And Tall Crutches is an excerpt where we really look at how we can create an equality that is about height. And so I extend my crutches up very high and jump up to meet Jess on eye level. And it's a very tiny, tiny slow dance, really, like the end of the night disco, where we're finally at the same height together
And Claire's balance, that should be said, is balancing herself on her arms with her feet about a foot and a half off the floor.
Oh my gosh, wow.
It's quite beautiful.
Let's hear that before I say thank you and thanks for coming in, Claire Cunningham and Jess Curtis.
Okay, thank you, David.
Information at counterpulse.org on these performances of The Way You Look at Me Tonight. Now here is an excerpt from Matthias Hermann's score, Tall Crutches, in which you'll also hear author-philosopher Dr. Alva Noe.
How can I interrupt this with a question? When I watch this, I'm fascinated by the way in which it switches back and forth between expressions of intimacy and closeness, like a slow dance, but then really intense, concentrated, negotiating, maneuvering, working together to maintain balance at the edge. The edge of balance. And the way in which the whole is organized by an intention.
The voice of Dr. Alva Noe as part of the Matthias Hermann score for Jess Curtis, Gravity, and Claire Cunningham in The Way You Look at Me Tonight. Performances through this weekend. Information at www.counterpulse.org. Good afternoon. It's open air here on KLW. Still to come, we'll be talking with Paul Drescher about his premiere work with the Berkeley Symphony next week. We'll also hear about Litquake 2016 from co-founder Jane Ganahl. And next, well, the San Francisco community is invited to another special event this weekend. It's a charitable concert featuring acclaimed trombone soloist Joseph Alessi and the World Doctors Orchestra this Saturday and Sunday. This all-volunteer orchestra is comprised of over 1,000 accomplished physician musicians from 50 nations and is laser-focused on its mission to use music as a means to end barriers to access to health care. Dr. Stefan Vilich is the founder and conductor of the World Doctors Orchestra. He studied violin, chamber music, and conducting in Stuttgart and Berlin. But his professional path took him first into medicine, where he became a highly regarded cardiologist and researcher focusing on cardiovascular disease prevention, health economics, integrative medicine, as well as incorporating music and medicine. From 2012 to 2014, Dr. Willick was president of the Music Conservatory Hans Eisler in Berlin. I'm joined by Maestro Willich and Shayna Burt, who is executive director and president of the board of directors of World Doctors Orchestra. Welcome to you both here to Open Air.
Hey, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Of course. Well, let's talk about the World Doctors Orchestra. People who are very laser-focused on their own careers in the world of medicine, but also at a very high level of performance.
Yeah, this orchestra includes doctors that are that have a very strong musical background. In fact, many of those had been professionally active musicians before they then decided to make medicine their career. But they live sort of a dual life, so they have a professional life as doctors, but they all love and have a great passion for music.
And this is part of a really a world tour of this 2016 program, which started in February in Thailand, was followed by three concerts in Romania in May, and now ends up with the concerts here in San Francisco and then Sacramento. The same program in each of these cities, or the program varies slightly?
No. We always have three sessions per year, and we have that we announce far in advance, and we put the ensemble together of those a total of 1,000 doctors, but we have different programs in all of those three sessions. Mm-hmm. So here it will be Mahler Symphony 1, and it will be two trombone concertos with Joe Alessio, who is principal trombone player from New York Philharmonic Orchestra, and he will play the David and the Tovey trombone concertos.
The hometown music hero, Joseph Alessi, we should say. He made himself quite a career for himself as both a soloist and clinician throughout the world. In the spring of 1985, since he was appointed principal trombone of the New York Philharmonic, he began his musical studies nearby in San Rafael with his father, who was also an acclaimed musician. He was a soloist with San Francisco Symphony as a high schooler before continuing at the Philadelphia's Curtis Institute of Music. So he will be performing a work that had him in mind, the Bramwell Tovey Lincoln Tunnel Cabaret. Tell us about that work, Dr. Willick.
It's a wonderful piece, and it's clearly a New York piece, as the title suggests already. It's a piece written particularly for Joe Alessi, and it's a great fun. It has a lot of jazz elements in it, and it's a truly remarkable and inspiring piece.
We're going to hear that shortly, but let's talk a little bit more about the organization of the World Doctors Orchestra with Shayna Burt, who is the executive director of the organization. That must be quite a challenge, having a worldwide organization to be in charge of.
It is. And actually, we have two organizations that are working together. We have the iteration that was formed in Berlin back in 2007 with their first concerts in 2008. And then in 2011, on the occasion of the 10th anniversary of September 11th, we did a concert in Washington, D.C. And that's when we incorporated here and began the Herculean task of trying to wrangle all of these type A physicians who also happen to have a passion for music.
Maestro Willich, I'm sorry, your pronunciation of your name, help me out.
Willich.
Yeah. Okay. Is it a challenge with these type A personalities, or do they all know that when your downbeat comes, you're the man in charge? No more. Put your scalpel down and pick up your bow.
No, frankly, it makes it rather easy because they're all used to very hard work and they have a huge passion for music. So that's a great pleasure to work together with them. And yeah.
And so you, in each of these centers of performance, you're dealing with a different organization of musicians. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have, if you want, a hard core of about 50 or so musicians that can play all the sessions, but many others can just do one per year, which is fine. But that means that we are like a big family where not all the members are always showing up. So there's always some fluctuation, which makes it even more exciting. And we also grew together as a group of friends over the years.
Mm-hmm. Your studying of conducting, is that it's now coming back to you as you perform with the doctor's orchestras?
Yeah, I mean, I studied music and also took a lot of conducting lessons, and it's a great privilege and a great pleasure, of course, to work with such gifted group of people and perform wonderful works, like, for example, the Mahler Symphony.
Stunning work. Shana Burt, in each of these cities, the idea is to benefit a international organization as well as a local organization. Tell us a little bit about the beneficiaries of these concerts.
Well, we make it a point to specifically identify a charity that's situated wherever that concert is going to be. We want to get the locals excited about something that's happening in their community. So, of course, we're always constantly raising money for the World Doctors Orchestra and its work, but we specifically focus on a charity there. Here, this time, we're focused on George Mark Children's House, which I had the pleasure of visiting yesterday. We dragged a quartet from the orchestra mm-hmm. over to the house, and we gave a small performance for some of the patients and their families, and it was absolutely gorgeous. I highly commend it to your listeners to check out their website. They are a charity that provides not just hospice care, so not just end-of-life care for children, but also respite care for parents of children who, have very demanding needs. So the parents get a little bit of a break, and they know that their children are in a safe, home-like environment, and also transitional care for those families who are making the move from being in the hospital all the time to getting back home. So it's just this beautiful facility, and I think they told me something like 80% of their budget is based on philanthropy. So what they do not raise, they cannot spend, and so it's a real privilege to be able to support them in with our San Francisco session.
The 20th concert of the World Doctors Orchestra is Saturday and Sunday evening at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Information at world-doctors-orchestra.org. Benefiting locally, the George Mark Children's House in San Leandro. Dr. Willick, so we talked a little bit about the excitement of doing Mahler here. You as a heart specialist, is your heart going to be left here in San Francisco, dare I say?
I can't believe you did that.
I'd clearly love to stay a little longer. That's such a very special place here, and we are very lucky, of course, with the weather, and have great conditions to perform and to practice here. Great. So we work very hard in these days to put the concert together.
Fantastic. Well, with the work with special soloist Joe Alessi in mind as trombone soloist, performing not only the Ferdinand David trombone concertino, but this Bramwell Tovey Lincoln Tunnel Cabaret. Let's have a little excerpt of that. Thanks you both for coming in, and I wish you wonderful performances here and around the world.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. The
Local boy made good, Joe Alessi's featured trombonist in two works with the World Doctors Orchestra. That a brief excerpt from Lincoln Tunnel Cabaret by Bramwell Tovey. Alessi also featured in Ferdinand David's Trombone Concertino, and the full orchestra will be performing Gustav Mahler's wonderful Symphony No. 1. world-doctors-orchestra.org for more information on those concerts Saturday and Sunday. Paul Drescher will be in shortly to talk about his world premiere of work for the Berklee Symphony, which is next Thursday evening. And we'll also hear from regular contributor Peter Robinson, who recorded an excerpt for the St. Matthew Passion excerpt. And next, well, I need to start this next segment with a warning. There's a chance of a major litquake in San Francisco this fall. It's been upgraded to 100%. The quake, which really started earlier today with a kids' quake event at the San Francisco Public Library, officially opens tomorrow evening at the Herbst Theater, I believe, with an opening night Shakespeare-themed opening and party at the Herbst in honor of the 400th anniversary of the Bard's death, and will roll throughout the week with its big close being the Lit Crawl, a literary pub crawl through the Mission, the following Saturday, the 15th. Litquake was founded by Bay Area writers in order to put on a week-long literary spectacle for book lovers with cutting-edge panels, unique cross-media events, and hundreds of readings. Since its founding in 1999, the festival has presented more than 7,000 author appearances for an audience of close to 150,000 in a lively and inclusive celebration of San Francisco's thriving literary scene. I'm pleased to be joined once again by one of Litquake's founders, Jane Ganahl, and she's we're also a media sponsor for Litquake, we should mention. Jane, welcome back to Open Air and KLW.
It's wonderful to be here. Thanks for having us.
Well, you're celebrating Shakespeare at 400. I just visited the Bard's birthplace and grave in Stratford-upon-Avon about this time yesterday in Stratford, so I'm a bit wondering what time zone I'm in.
I was going to say, how are you upright and intelligent at this
point? I managed to get enough sleep last night, so I think I'm okay. But it's interesting because I learned quite a bit, not at Stratford Avon, but from my partner Ron Seeley about the questionable authorship of a lot of Shakespeare's work and whether it was indeed the Earl of Oxford, Edward de Vere, or some other folks. Now, we're celebrating Shakespeare. Is there going to be any kind of discussion about perhaps other authors of the Bard's works?
Well, you know, I hate to disappoint, you know, serious students of the Bard, but this is really going to be just a big party. It's just going to be a big blowout. We're going to have, we will have a few offerings in terms of programming, but we've discovered over the years that if you put too much programming in your opening night party, people just kind of don't pay attention.
Zone out.
Yeah, so we're going to have SF Shakespeare doing a very brief performance of Shakespeare's bawdiest words. So this is probably not for children. there will be Shakespearean insults. There'll be, you know, period attire. And then poetry by Gary Soto, who's the author of a new book called You Kiss by the Book. Each poem begins with a line from Shakespeare. So there'll be some programming, but mostly it'll be Shakespeare-inspired cocktails and revelry.
You're also aiming, I mentioned things started off today with a kids' quake thing. You're also aiming at some teens as well to get them involved in Litquake.
That's right. We have an amazing woman volunteer, a Summer Laurie, who who heads up Teen Quake every year, and she works her day job is with Books Incorporated doing teen book programming and whatnot, and she has put together a couple of pretty amazing events, one of which I believe involves pizza to get them to come. But, you know, at Lit Quake, we realize that it's wonderful to have all these adult readers, but we need to be raising readers. We need to be training children and teens to still love books.
That's great. All-star lineup includes a whole Pulitzer night, a veritable Pulitzer Palooza on October 11th.
Right.
Tell us about the Pulitzer winners that are being presented.
Well, it turns out it's the centennial of the Pulitzer Prizes this year, and so we know we have a good Rolodex with some really good names, and so we're having Jane Smiley, who won the Pulitzer for fiction in the 90s. She's going to be in conversation with the poet Robert Haas, who won the Pulitzer in 2008. And then we will have a separate conversation between two nonfiction Pulitzer winners. One of them is Richard Rhodes, who won for his book about the atom bomb. And then T.J. Stiles, who is actually a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner in nonfiction. So that should be interesting, because we love to just sort of take two amazing authors and tell them, go forth and talk about whatever suits you, because generally speaking, the audience just soaks it up.
Well, speaking of going forth and talking whatever comes to his mind, Bay Area favorite Daniel Handler will be part
yes.
of the lineup, talking with Michelle T. Daniel, also known as Lemony Snicket. Lemony Which persona Snicket. Will he adopt? Does anyone know at this point?
I think for this night, he will probably just be Daniel Handler, because I'm fairly certain that he will have a drink in his hand, and that probably doesn't go over well with the wee ones.
That'll be on October 9th at the American Bookbinders Museum, in conversation with Michelle T. about her new book, Black Wave.
Yes.
Also, please go ahead.
Well, she's sadly left us in the last year. She's moved to L.A., but she is a perennial favorite here in San Francisco for her kind of groundbreaking books that feature the LGBT community. So we're thrilled that she's coming up here for this.
On the 11th, well, actually the 14th at the Swedish American Hall, a fascinating event at 8:30 with Thomas Dolby and his mm-hmm. memoir, The Speed of Sound, Breaking the Barriers Between Music and Technology. Thomas Dolby, I mean, one can only think.
Blinded me with science.
Dolby, yes, indeed.
Yes, no, he's actually, I did not realize until I started hearing about this book earlier this year, that he went from his sort of pop music career to actually being an inventor in Silicon Valley and developing some pretty important technologies. And so now he's sort of written a memoir about his life. So it will be sort of an interesting hodgepodge of, I think there will be a little music, there will be a conversation, and I'm sure it will be extremely fascinating to those of us who kind of miss that part of pop music history.
That'll be on the 14th at 8:30. Mm-hmm. Again, more information, and you'll hear a lot about this on KLW Airwaves, as we're a media sponsor, litquake.org. And then just one other highlight, the 50 years of Hunter Thompson.
Yeah, we're really excited about
50
that.
50 years, I get.
Well, it's 50 years since his first book, which was Hell's Angels. And so we're having people who knew him and one of his editors, actually, and coming to sort of just tell stories. So it's going to be a great night of hearing vivid and probably completely inappropriate stories. But we're very excited to make that happen.
And the Lit Crawl, of course, is a highlight, finishing things out on the 15th.
Right. This year we have almost 100 venues all through the Mission District.
Oh, my gosh.
It's pretty insane.
That's going to be a crazy Saturday, the 15th. More information at litquake.org. Jane, thanks for sharing a few highlights.
Oh, thank you for having us.
We'll have you again. And again, you'll hear more on KLW Airwaves about Lit Quake 2016.
Hi, I'm Peter Robinson, and my guest today is Paul Flight. We've just heard a little entry piece from the St. Matthew Passion. Paul is, of course, the long-standing conductor for the California Bach Society. So welcome, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, glad to be here.
And let's talk a little bit about the St. Matthew Passion, because I think there were three original introductions. There was the 1725, 1727, and I think you're going with the 1736 version.
That's right. We're going with the later version that Bach adapted after having thought a little bit about what he wanted, you know. It's an interesting piece because Bach partnered with a very fine librettist named Henrici Picander, his pen name, and together they fashioned the libretto, which takes a number of biblical passages and then reflects on them to a large degree. Bach does this very successfully by writing arias, which have special texts by Picander that reflect upon the action that's just transpired. And in the same way, Bach also inserted chorales into the piece so that the people singing the chorales, perhaps in this case the congregation back in 1736, could then reflect themselves on the biblical events or the passion events that have transpired.
And this 1736 involved an instrument change from the lute to
small changes. So yeah. In the aria Cum Susus Kreutz, the original was for a lute player, but in 1736 Bach changed it to a gamba player. It's a very, very difficult gamba solo, with lots of wide leaps and fanciful figurations. I don't know if it's difficult on the lute, but it certainly is on the gamba.
Now, you're going to be performing, in fact, in three different places, in Palo Alto, in the city here, and then in the East Bay.
That's right.
And can we talk a little bit about the acoustics in the different churches?
So on Friday evening, October 7th, we'll be at the First Unitarian Church, which is on Geary, just above Van Ness. It's a very big room, but it's got great clarity. It's a very narrow stage for the performers, which is going to cause us to be quite cramped. But it's a very nice place to hear the concert. It's not a cavernous space which echoes. It has very nice clarity in the acoustic. Then on Saturday, we are in a more cavernous space in Palo Alto, the First United Methodist Church, which is a very favored venue for a lot of local groups, especially Philharmonia Baroque and others. But it's more difficult for the performers to be heard in the space. Somehow the sound gets sucked up a little bit. And then on Sunday, we're in First Congregational Church, Berkeley, in the afternoon. And it's a wonderful, wonderful space. Very, very crisp and very lively acoustic, but with excellent clarity. A little more kind of sparkle than the other venues.
And tell me, in Bach's time or day, Bach, would there have been balconies where people would have singing from different sides, or would they all be ensemble together?
No, in fact, that's an interesting phenomenon. In the Thomaskirche, there are balconies, and Bach was able to separate his choir 1 and choir 2, and subsequently his orchestra 1 and 2, into separate balconies. And that really enhances the spatial separation, that double choir effect for the listener.
And you have 40 people in your choir. That's
yes,
great. Yeah.
Yes, we have 40 amateur singers. And we oftentimes the piece is done with 8 soloists and then a Jesus and an evangelist. We have 4 principal soloists, of which Mark is our fine bass baritone. And then we have a Jesus and a narrator and several minor roles that will be sung by people in the choir.
And Mark, in fact, Mark Pantas, I should introduce, is also my second guest today. He is fresh off the plane. He has come in from what I used to call Holland, but I've now been told, in fact, is the Netherlands. And separate to appearing in the Matthew Passion, you're also involved in Heinrich Heine's poems set to music.
Yes.
And what does that involve?
Well,
since I was here, I thought, well, I can make it a little more worthwhile to also bring Dutch classical music to California and New York, by the way. And it's been 3 years ago that I have made a CD with music set to poems of Heinrich Heine by only Dutch composers from the 19th century and some from the 20th century and even one from this century, our century, because, well, for several reasons, it's fantastic music. No one knows it. Also, not in the Netherlands. We all know our painters, but the musicians or the composers are hardly known. And I thought it was
so. This is a hidden secret from the Netherlands that you're bringing here to California. And I know we've got a short track from your CD, and I'm just wondering whether we could hear that now. And this, of course, is a piece by Heinrich Heine.
Mein Herz jubelt dir, mein Herz, und stürmisch folgt es deiner schönen Spur.
Now, for those of us who don't speak, dare I say it, German, could you give us a rough explanation of what he's actually talking about?
Well, this is a funny poem about a man in an encounter with a woman whose dress is touching him while she passes, and that stirs everything in him so much that he's completely disturbed and can't follow her anymore. That's the whole.
So in California, a geographic area of political correctness, he or she is bordering on something that today wouldn't be allowed.
I think you can still be excited by I don't think it's not allowed to be excited by anything, really.
So tell me, you make the transition from the Matthew Passion to this. How do you see that in your own head? What do you visualize when you're making this transition?
Oh, well, the use of the voice is, of course, very different in Bach. It's a bit lower in general because it's a real bass part, and the songs usually are for baritone, or there is a different. You need more colors to sing songs to make, like, you are supposed to have a voix mixte, which is a very high, thin voice that you have to be. It's just you're usually singing with more colors than you would need for Bach, although it's always very nice to sing Bach as well with as many colors as you can fit in. But of course, the Baroque music is different in that respect.
Mm-hmm. And maybe this is a question for both of you. There are some orchestras which play with the original instruments, and then there are others where we go with what we have today. Do you have any feeling about this in terms of instrumental change? Over to you, Paul.
I do. I have strong feelings about it. I think that the period instruments lend a particular color that you can't get with modern instruments. The oboes tend to be a bit softer. Modern oboes tend to dominate texture. And the other thing that's quite interesting is that the pitch level for these early instruments is a semitone lower. That's A415, which for the singers is a wonderful turn of events, because the choral parts are written, the tessitura is quite high. Mm-hmm. At modern pitch. And so when you pull things down a half tone, it really gives an added warmth to the chorus's timbre as well. Mm-hmm. And I think, at least speaking for myself, I've sung the alto solos many times, and to do them at modern pitch has always presented me with a problem.
So you prefer the original instruments?
I like the original instruments and the lower pitch.
And yourself?
Oh, definitely. It makes life much easier for the singers. Mm. Even for the bass, although, like, Bach always writes very high for tenors. We as lower voices usually have less difficulties, but even for basses, it's very we're always very pleased if we can sing a half tone lower.
Yes.
Well, this sounds like a very exciting musical performance, and Paul Flight, who is the conductor of the California Bach Society, can you just give us some information how people can reach you and if they want to buy tickets?
So we have a website where one can go to get information about purchasing tickets. It's www.kalbach.org. www.kalbach.org. And of course, tickets are available at the door as well.
At the door. And Mark, you're going to be performing in different places around the Bay Area.
Yes.
Where will we be likely to find you?
Well, on Saturday, October 22nd, at 4 p.m., I will be singing at the Noe Valley Ministry in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And on Sunday, October 23rd, in Berkeley at the Berkeley Piano Club. And if people would like to get tickets, then it's easiest to get all the information from my Facebook page, which is facebook.com/NAFNorCal, because these concerts have been supported greatly by the Netherlands America Foundation. And the website address would be facebook.com/NAFNorCal, NAFNORCAL.
Well, I want to thank you both. It sounds like a great evening, both in first with the St. Matthew Passion and then later with a musical event based on the poems of Heinrich Heine. And perhaps we can go out with just a little touch more of that St. Matthew Passion. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And thanks to Peter Robinson, regular contributor here for KLW's Open Air, for talking with Paul Flight and Mark Pantis. We do have some tickets to give away for those performances of the St. Matthew Passion. Two pair for San Francisco Friday at the First Unitarian Church on Franklin Avenue. Two pairs for Palo Alto on Saturday and the matinee in Berkeley on Sunday at Hertz Hall. Call us here at 415-841-4134. Performances of St. Matthew Passion, 415-841-4134. Well, I'm pleased to be joined once again by someone who has been accurately described in the Berkeley Symphony press release as a musical omnivore, and someone who is a good friend of KLW as well, Paul Drescher, whose work Crazy Eights and Fractured Symmetries is receiving its world premiere with the Berkeley Symphony a week from today at Zellerbach Hall under the direction of guest conductor Edwin Atwater. Paul joins me in studio to talk briefly, ever so briefly, oh, too briefly, about that work. Hey, Paul, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, let's talk about the title, first of all, Crazy Eights and Fractured Symmetries. What did you come up with then?
Well, it's basically has to do with the harmonic foundation of the work. I worked a lot in this piece with octatonic modes, and that's just a technical term that just basically means alternating whole steps and half steps. And if you know anything about music theory, there are three different octatonic scales within any given 12-tone scale. And so I used them, and I started to manipulate them a lot of ways, and I kept fracturing them. I kept breaking them apart. I would fracture them in different ways. And so there's a lot of symmetries, because an octatonic scale is symmetric. But then there's lots of... And I use those symmetries and to build up structures, and then I break them. So there's a lot of back and forth between symmetrical harmonic material and then broken harmonic material, which yields some very interesting, sometimes very consonant, sometimes very dissonant materials.
And no special instruments created for this? It's unusual for you to use just a regular symphony orchestra, isn't it?
I don't think that's unusual, but obviously the last major work I did with the Berkeley Symphony was for the quadricord and with me as a soloist, and that was a very unusual work for a variety of reasons, not just because of the invented instrument, but because of the tuning as well. But this is a traditional orchestra work. In fact, I was asked to, if possible, to match the orchestration of the Korngold Violin Concerto, upon which it shares the same half of the program. So my work opens the concert, and then the Korngold Violin Concerto is the second work on the program.
With Philippe Quint as soloist in the violin concerto, and then the concert concludes with Stravinsky's Petrushka, berkeleysymphony.org. More about that. Did your 2010 work, Cornucopia, also use unique instruments, or was it strictly the symphony?
That piece premiered in 1990 with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, but the first time I worked with the Berkeley Symphony was they performed that piece in 2010. And that's when Joanna first encountered my music and has become a very big supporter, obviously, or they wouldn't have commissioned two additional works since then.
And I need to ask you how Chic Machine went over. I was AWOL for that in jolly old England. How did Chic Machine go?
Chic Machine was wonderful. Stephen Chic, I mean, I've almost come to just sort of you know, take it for granted that he does superlative, perfect performances every time. And even the sections where he improvises, because there's a fair amount of improvisation in the work, he just does something wonderful every time. So, they were wonderful. And in fact, I just literally came here from loading a 53-foot shipping container for Schick Machine being sent to the University of Maryland, which is where it performs next on the 21st of October.
Are you going to go out and hear those performances?
Oh, yeah. There's no way. I mean, the piece, the crew that performed it, you know, Steve is the only person on stage, but there are six other people involved in making everything happen, both assembling the machines and running them and the lighting and the projections and the sound engineering and things like that. So there's a crew of six people go.
Wow.
And so you see one person on stage, but there's a lot of people off stage doing very critical roles. And so, the whole production travels.
Not to spend more time on Schick Machine, but that also has performances beyond Maryland, or what happens after
that? At the moment, it doesn't. We're hoping to get it to New York. And, you know, and we may, in a few years, we may bring it back to the Bay Area. People said to me, you know, it feels fresher than when I first saw it. And we were very gratified. We had bigger audiences than when we first had it here in San Francisco. And nobody feels like the piece has run its course. And least of us, Steve or I, feel like the piece has a lot more legs.
Great, great. And tell us, what about Crazy Eights and Fractured Symmetries? What's going on with that?
Well, we'll find out after the premiere. I think, you know, with most orchestral works, people want to hear a recording. And then if the conductor says it's a fabulous piece, or they say this is a piece that you should consider performing, hopefully it'll have a future. Also, I've always found that I want to make certain revisions after the premiere of a large scale work. And while this is only a 15-minute work, I'm already imagining, as I'm going over the score and answering questions that Edwin has posed to me, I said, you know, maybe I can do a little bit better on this section. And so I won't do that before this performance. I'll hear how it goes, and then I'll make a decision if there are things that could be focused or amplified.
And a very limited time to rehearse this. Edwin Atwater stepping in for the last minute for Joanna Carnero.
Right.
And you just have a couple of rehearsals next week, and then it's boom, Thursday's performance.
That's right.
Opening.
Yeah. But that's the way it is in the orchestra world. You don't have extended periods of rehearsal. I mean, unless maybe on a John Adams work, a particularly large-scale work, you know, they might rehearse it for several weeks. But this is very standard, and it won't be just my work. I mean, the Petrushka will get that treatment, as will the Korngold Violin Concerto.
Sure. We have a very limited time to hear just a brief excerpt, and it's a MIDI excerpt of Crazy Eights and Fractured Symmetries. What are we going to hear in the beginning here?
So this is the very top of the work, and it's a little bit unlike what most people come to expect from me, which is, I mean, I'm sort of considered a classic minimalist in some way, although I consider myself a pre-maximalist as opposed to a post-minimalist. And this piece is more in the maximal mode, I suppose, at least. There's two very contrasting dynamics in the work. At the top, depending on how far we go, we may only hear the first part.
Paul Drescher's Crazy Eights and Fractured Symmetries, opening the Berkeley Symphony's 2016-17 season. Paul, thanks for coming in.
Great to be here.
Information at berkeleysymphony.org. use of the contrabassoon there in Paul Drescher's Crazy Eights and Fractured Symmetries, a Berklee Symphony premiere which opens the 2016-17 season in Zellerbach Hall next Thursday, October 13th, at 7 p.m. start. That concert will also include Stravinsky's Petrushka and Philippe Quint as soloist in Korngold's Violin Concerto.